one of research we did, and we have really good data on like sows mortality reduction and reduction of use of antibiotics and reduction of lameness, was using rubber mats on the pens. So that was a really interesting study we did in North Carolina last year. And we're still working on the data, but as a spoiler, we have better outcomes on our sows that are in the group housing. We still need to manage like the temperature control because you have the rubber mat and all of that. But thinking about the fighting, reproduction losses, and other survival during the gestation period, we saw some really cool production data on it.
The Swinet Podcast Show Canada is only possible with the support and trust of innovative companies like
DietForge.ai. AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. When it comes to 25-hydroxy D3 products, purity matters. Hy-D is a pure, effective 25-hydroxy D3 solution to help pigs improve their vitamin D status. Learn more at hy-d.info. Top Pigs Norsvin, the world's most innovative swine genetics company.
Welcome to the Swinet Canada podcast show brought to you by Wisenetics. We are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the Canadian pork industry. So my name is Miranda Smith, and I'll be the host for today's episode. And today's guest is Dr. Laia Alves, who is a postdoctoral researcher and coordinator of teaching, research, innovation, and extension at the Swine Research Lab at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. So welcome to the show, Laia.
Hello, Miranda. It's really a pleasure to be here today talking to all of you in Canada. I'm here in Brazil, so it's a great pleasure to be here today.
Awesome. So today we're going to be talking about like welfare regulations across different countries and kind of like the implications for some economics and production. But before we get started, can you first introduce yourself a little bit?
Of course. So my name is Laia Canan Silva Alves. I'm an animal scientist. I have a master's and a PhD in swine production. I did 1 year study abroad in North Carolina State University. And currently I'm a researcher at the University of São Paulo here in Brazil. And what I've been working for the past few years, like my research has been focusing on swine welfare, pen management, timely euthanasia, and a little bit of the economic implications of welfare-related decisions in pig production. I know it's a lot, but when we think about the pig production, I think we need to try to put all of it together and have a more holistic approach of it. So kind of combining a little bit of expertise in everything. So we've been collaborating with international research groups and trying to work on applied welfare science and decision-making tools for producers, veterinarians, and everyone on the farms.
Okay, perfect. So the first question that I would have is like, how are animal welfare regulations evolving across different countries? And what are some of the challenges that producers may be facing when adapting these changes?
I think, first of all, we need to think that animal welfare has evolved from being viewed like an ethical add-on to becoming like a central component of sustainable pig production across the world. This is not like specific to Canada, specific to Brazil or any other country. I think the vision has been kind of like we're moving forward on this ethical, this obligation producers have. And today, welfare is closely linked to market access, to consumer trust, and also the regulatory compliance of it. So what we've been seeing globally is like a growing demand for science-based welfare with practices that will be applied on the farm, like they're feasible to do and the producers can actually apply for it. So we can just have a real scenario and something that we can change the life of the pigs. So this is what we've been observing around the world, like, on my opinion and my perspective. And thinking about the challenges that producers may face, I think one of the biggest challenges is translating these welfare requirements into daily routines without compromising the economic sustainability. So we have a lot of regulations. We have a lot of very cool and very science-based documents around the globe. But how we make sure this is being translated to the producers so they can understand what they have to do, how they do these changes, and what type of policies we have in our different countries to help them make that possible and real and actually implement those changes in the farms. So in my point of view, I think producers there are 100% willing to improve welfare, but they need these clear protocols, they need a lot of training, and they need supporting decision support tools to make this change like feasible.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So can you talk a little about, like, more specifically about some of the welfare regulations that people are currently dealing with?
I think when we talk about welfare and pig production, the number one question we have is related to the sows housing. So we're talking about the crates for gestating, and now some countries are already talking about this on the farrowing units. Some countries are still trying to deal with the gestation crates. So we have different steps being done in different countries. In Brazil, for example, we have a really big, it's not even a regulation, but it's not a legislation that is talking about how we need to move these sows from gestation crates to the group housing 35 days after breeding. But we have this and producers understand, but we specify stocking density and how much space we need to provide for each sow. But we also see a lot of problems with how we group those sows, how do we manage them? And we've been seeing increasing numbers with sow mortality. And like, we're having a lot of problems with lameness and all of this with like all the reproductive numbers of our sows. So this has been a big problem. And I think we have a really great way of moving forward with it. And the regulations are very important, but we also need to kind of combine strategies instead of having different countries working on the same thing, but in different moments and doing the same mistakes and not evolving enough, even though we have the science to kind of be our foundation. But I think we're not communicating really well our results between different countries. So sometimes we are doing some mistakes that other countries already deal with it and try to fix it in some way. And we could be adapting that for our farms and for local requirements. So one example like that is the most talked one is like the sows housing systems, but also we have another different like tail docking and castration and euthanasia, a lot of things that we need to improve and keep working on it.
Yeah, so in Canada, the sow housing is actually also a big topic because in 2029, we have to all switch to group sow housing. So it's interesting that you bring that one up because it is very timely here as well. And it's interesting when you say that we can learn from other countries because some countries are ahead, right? So so have you kind of seen some information on that in your research?
Yeah, so when we look at different countries, for example, if you look at European countries that did this transition years ago, they face the same problems as us we've been facing. And I'm not sure if they figure it out the way to do it because they closed a lot of farms. They are not producing the same amount they used to. But what I do think we can work on it is just like Canada, Brazil, United States, we have very similar production systems and we're kind of moving on the same direction at the same time. Because here in Brazil, for example, we have until 2045, so to do this transition. So we have a little bit of extra time with farms that already exist, but new farms, they need to be built with group housing. So we've been doing research on how we improve the sows overall health, how we manage those groups to reduce how they're fighting and how many losses do we have. But there is still no answer like 100%. One of research we did, and we have really good data on like sows mortality reduction and reduction of use of antibiotics and reduction of lameness, was using rubber mats on the pens. So that was a really interesting study we did in North Carolina last year, and we're still working on the data, but as a spoiler, we have better outcomes on our sows there are in the group housing. We still need to manage like the temperature control because you have the rubber mat and all of that, but thinking about the fighting, reproduction losses, and other survival during the gestation period, we saw some really cool production data on it. So we have strategies, right? Working with enrichment for these sows so they are not fighting all the time, respecting the space, thinking really well about the nutrition of the sows. Are we providing what they need? Are we providing satiety? Are we giving them enough space to run away if they start fighting? Are we putting sows there? Are we putting gills with sows? We should not be doing that. How big are our groups? So all of that, right? And when you think about it, you always go back to the management practices. It's pretty easy to just build a new facility and put ourselves inside. But how we train the people that are dealing with these sows on what they need to provide for them. So I think this is the biggest challenge we have. And in all countries, we're moving forward with it. And I don't think a lot of countries figure it out that yet, because they don't even have the number of manpower that we have working on farms. So for them, it's even harder to work with it.
And it's not just training of the people, though. I think like the animals need to be trained as well, right? Like that's, I think, one of the big things in like, you cannot just move a guild or a sow into a group sow house and be like, okay, good luck. there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, that's a very interesting topic, because I talk about that with the students a lot. We've been selecting our sows for so many years to be on crates, and they are very well adapted to those crates. So they are used to being alone. They are using to eat at that certain time. They are using to that environment. And then one day we decide to just like, okay, you are free, do whatever for the whole day. And then this is when we start having that many problems. They have no social skills, even though it's species specific. But these sows have been selected for so many years to do well in this environment. So we need to start working with like their behavior and providing material and enrichment, so they are busy doing other things than just trying to fight with the other sow that is close to them, right? And the best way to do this is providing a good environment with good nutrition and enrichment and all that. That will help. We don't know yet if those that will solve the problem, but having an ideal system will depend on where we are. And I think we do need to do a lot of research, which is good for us. So we still have things to learn and research and keep trying to find answers.
So like you earlier mentioned, like some of the other types of regulations around like castration, like pain management. So can you talk a little bit about pain management and what that kind of looks like?
Right. So when we talk about pain management, right now is more focused on castration and tail docking. So it's about the processing of piglets. And I feel like regulations been talking about the obligation of provide some type of analgesia and anesthesia for piglets undergoing the castration process. And I'm using a lot of Brazilian examples, but because here we are 70% of our production is already using immunocastration. So our legislation made it like mandatory to use anesthesia and analgesia for surgical castration. But then it's not that a big deal, because most of our farms are not even doing that type of castration anymore, like big integrators and companies' farms, they're not doing it anymore. But then we have independent producers and producers on countries like United States. They're like 100% doing surgical castration. And this regulation's been like, if you're doing it until, it doesn't matter the age of the piglet, if it's 3 days old, 5 days old, 7 days old, you need to use some type of analgesia. And the recommendation is like, just do it until they're maximum of 10 days old, because then you can try to control it. And we see a lot of protocols. We do have a lot of research working with flunixin, meloxicam, ketoprofen, basically on trying to mitigate this, but we're not being consistent with our results at all. So in some cases, we see a little bit of improvement in one variable, like we can reduce a little bit of cortisol in that acute phase in 1 hour post-castration. But then when we look at behavior scores and use other metrics, we're seeing behaviors related to pain. And we're still seeing inflammation. So we still do not have, until now, one protocol well-established in the entire globe that actually works. And it's like, this one is accurate and you're guaranteed that the piglet is in a good state of analgesia and it's not in pain. What we've been seeing is like, we identify that is an acute pain response. So we know the worst time points is 1 hour post-castration. and 3 hours post-castration. After that, you see some residual responses in cortisol levels, in behavior responses, but they're actually decreasing, so which is good. It means like, okay, we're being able to help some way, but we still didn't found the best way to provide it. It's like an injection, is using different free needle approaches like intranasal. We've been doing some research with it too. And we're using only one drug. Maybe we should do protocols with more than one drug because we have an effect in an acute phase. And then you have another one that will have an analgesic effect in 3 hours. So we're keeping this drug with the animal for a prolonged time. So until now, we do not have a specific protocol that works. But at least I think we're moving forward on understanding when do we need to act and what types of protocols we need to start researching more, and also validating a lot of methodologies. Because when we read the papers, everyone is doing a different thing. And this goes back to, we need to join forces globally as a industry, like swine industry, because then you have researchers in Brazil working with some type of protocol, and then researchers in Canada doing a different one, and we're all trying to fight the same problem. So we're doing the same mistakes instead of having like a global conjoined group trying to find, okay, let's find a protocol that works.
Yes, I agree on that. So in Canada, I think a lot of people are using meloxicam, and they provide it at the moment of the castration until docking. But I've also read that maybe it's better to use, to add it like an hour before you do it or something like that. But then you have to handle the piglets twice, and that's also stressful. So so like when it comes to meloxicam, have you found what might work the best?
Not yet, but we saw some like raw data on it, and 1 hour before the castration is, yes, the best solution. But then you need to think about all the handling, and with this disposal, this free needle approach we've been trying to do, it's a little bit easier because you just do intranasally like the drug. So it's still stressful because you still have to handle the pig, but at least you're not doing the injection. It's more safe and all that. So you do that 1 hour before and then you come castrating. But we're not being consistent with our results so far, with meloxicam at certain dosage being good. What we've been seeing on some behavioral responses, for example, ketoprofen is being the best drug for behavior pain related responses. So like, when you look at cortisol levels, meloxicam is really good. And then when you look at behavior responses, ketoprofen is really good. And this is why we're trying to think maybe we need to combine some drugs to try to act in different moments, or how we do that approach better. And also using lidocaine too in some of protocols has been showing good responses too. But it also goes back to how you're going to apply that. Sometimes the handling stress is so much that it's not worth it, because you're all these levels and all these parameters just go higher and greater and greater, and then you don't have like really accurate results on it. So
maybe we'll need to have you back on the show once you find the best approach.
That's the plan. We're doing right now a big grant with like 3 or 4 different universities trying to find like, first of all, we're just refining the methodology, just doing again and again and again until we find the best way to collect the data. And we got that now. So now we're going to move forward to trying different protocols. And our goal is in the next 3 years to have a protocol for the industry and be like, okay, this one, we're 100% confident that works, so we can move forward with it.
Okay, perfect. I'm looking forward to that.
I will share the results with you.
Yes, that would be great. So like another thing that we sometimes forget to think about or talk about when it comes to welfare is euthanasia. But euthanasia is a very important part of animal welfare. So can you talk a little bit about why it is such a critical component of animal welfare, and how can we do like have better decision making and training to improve outcomes on farm?
I think euthanasia is one, if not the most important topic when we think about welfare, because just keeping an animal on your farm that is in pain and is suffering and has no chance to recover is not acceptable. But what we see when we go to farms, and I personally go to farms a lot because I like to see what they're doing and talking to the caretakers about how do they feel about things. And we did this cool research on my PhD that actually we use these things I like to do, that is go and talk about their feelings. And we had a really cool paper showing that people are really empathetic towards swine. So people that work on farms, they're like, they understand the animal has feelings and they understand they feel pain and they really care about these animals they're taking care of every day. And that's also a big problem because they feel like, I'm here to take care of this animal. And yes, it's an animal that is going to become food for people, but inside of the farm, this is, I'm taking care of it. So the idea of killing an animal just because you're walking and it doesn't feel great, they do not like it. So they usually postpone the decision and they try like, okay, I'm going to leave this piglet over here and my colleague on the next shift will look at it and make the decision for me. So they just do not do timely euthanasia decisions at all because they are 100% uncomfortable with it. So it's more related to, I do not like to do this. I didn't sign up. My job is not to kill animals, it's to take care of them. So, and I don't understand why we need to do this. And when we talk with them and we saw all this cool data, basically we saw that most of the farms and caretakers did not receive any training on euthanasia. And we know on the documentation and legislation, this is a veterinarian task to perform. But when we think about big production farms, that is not the what happens. It doesn't matter the country. The ones doing euthanasia and making the decisions are the caretakers. It's impossible to have a vet on the farm every single day making those decisions. So when we talk to them, you see like there is no training and they are not comfortable with the decision and they do not feel prepared to do it, or they know how to do it. The problem we saw was like, it's not like they don't know the methods, they don't have the equipment. It's just like they don't know how to make the decision on a timely manner and they're not comfortable. And then what we also saw, and this is like, we have studies in Brazil, United States, in Europe. So all showing the same trends. It's just like people are not comfortable with it and they're not being trained. And we developed this training material. And then when we train people, they improve their confidence like more than 90%. They feel way better. They state that like, we understand now how important it is to make sure this animal is not in pain, is not suffering. So the fastest I make this decision and I'm confident that is a case that really requires euthanasia, better is for the animal. So it all goes back to training, right? So they know the methods, they know, they have empathy towards the animal, but they're not comfortable. And this is our job, like industry, to train these people, because at the end of the day, they are making the decision. So they need to be confident on their knowledge so they know the time to do it. And they're like feeling good about it, because I think no one likes to do euthanasia, but also you need to feel good about it because you're like, okay, this animal is not suffering anymore. So I made the right decision and there is no better welfare than this. Just making sure an animal is not suffering. So I think that's something that we need to talk more on farms and as an industry too, even with like veterinarians and animal scientists and professionals that are working on extension programs, everyone, we need to talk more openly about euthanasia and be more comfortable with it because it's really, really important.
And would you suggest that it should be the veterinarians to train the caretakers, or should it be the supervisor, or does it not really matter as long as it's someone who is competent?
I think since you have like a program developed by a veterinarian with like the approach you need to take, whatever you need to look on the animal, how are the measures, which are the animal-based measures you need to be looking, and you have like a very well-done training, I think everyone can do it, right? So I think supervisors are able to train these people too, if they have a protocol to follow, if they have the guidelines written by a vet and making sure we're doing this the right methods, that we're guaranteeing sensibilization of the animal, no pain during the procedure and all of that. And then most of that is just like training people on doing general observations is something we talk here a lot. It's just, you cannot euthanize an animal if you do not walk on the barn and observe your animals. So the first, the most important thing of an euthanasia protocol is just training people to look to the animals, walk on the barns and make sure they're like moving, they're all in good health. And if they're not, okay, we need to separate this animal. Do we have a hospital pen over here? This is a very important thing too, that often we do not talk about hospital pens. So I'm making sure I have this animal in a separate area where I can be looking at it and following how it's evolving or not, so I can make the decisions, right? So that's the first step of any care protocol. It doesn't matter if you're going to do euthanasia or a treatment, or if you're just going to do like a different whatever. You need to provide more warmth for the animal. It's just like you need to look at the animal and identify a compromised animal first. And there's no way to do that without a person going to the barn and checking on the animals every single day.
Yeah, makes sense. Have you looked at different types of euthanasia and if that has an effect on how people feel about doing euthanasia?
100%. We have some methods that are like, they're not 100% comfortable. For example, here in Brazil, it's still allowed to do blunt force trauma in piglets. And that's a method that visually is not good at all. For the piglet, if it's well done, we have data supporting that it's a good method and the animal is unconscious really fast. But it doesn't matter, because if the person that is performing the method is not comfortable with it, how can you assure this method is doing on a great manner, right? It's doing properly. Because if I'm not comfortable, I'm going to think about it before I do it. And then sometimes you don't have the blunt force trauma being done properly. So when we train supervisors and veterinarians on how to develop these protocols, we always say there is no protocol for everyone. We have approved methods, but you need to see what your caretakers are comfortable with, because if they're not, they're not going to do it. They're not going to perform. Another, the captive boats, sometimes caretakers are not comfortable with it too, because they see all the reflex and all the movements after the protocol is done, and they think that is like the animal is trying to stand up, is trying to run away, and you're like, no, this is a total 100% response of the body. The animal is unconscious, it's not here anymore, it's blunt, it's dead, it's a captive, penetrating captive boat. It's just a response of different phases of post-mortem, but there's no way they can know that if you do not train and teach them that, right? So they're not comfortable, and then you train and you explain, they're like, oh, okay, so this is a good method. And you're like, this is one of the best. It's really fast, and there's basically no way if you miss it if you're holding the animal properly. So you're guaranteeing that they're comfortable with whatever they have to do.
Yeah, I remember going to a farm where they were using the captive bolt gun for piglets, and they had a really nice thing where they can just like place the piglet in a thing. And so like, it's really easy to place the gun in the right way, because they don't need to hold the piglet and the gun at the same time. And I was like, wow, like it was so fast and so smooth.
And well done, right?
Yes. Yes. So like, I was amazed by that. And I think that would be a great thing to implement.
And those holders, this is the cool thing about people being creative, because you have the captive boat, but then you have no holder, just like you immobilize the animal the way you think is best. And then people that are using and need to use that every day, they are creative enough to think about a solution. And when they do, you find these amazing things on the field, on the farm, that you will never see if you don't go to a farm and be like, okay, this idea is actually great. How can we do this? And bring it to different farms too, so they can also use it, because it's really good for the animals. So that's a really cool point. And I saw the one you're talking about, very adept, and it's like the piglet is just sitting there, it's really fast.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so last question before we run out of time, because you mentioned a little bit economics of all these welfare regulations. So can you talk a little bit about the economics of all of these things?
Of course. So first of all, welfare legislation does involve costs, especially when you're on this transition phase. As you say, Canada has to change their farms until 2029 to have group housing and all that. That has a cost, but When we see these practices being implemented on the right way, many of them will reduce the long-term losses by improving animal health, productivity, and decision-making efficiency. So I don't think the real issue is on the legislation and the cost we have of it. It's more like how well we are supporting these producers during the implementation of these legislations or regulations we have. So how do we have any type of policies to help them to implement it? Because we did a bit of research in different types of group housing compared to conventional crates on economic research. And I can send the material so we can put on the, for, send it to people too. And as we expected, we saw greater costs for group housing that you keep the sows in crates until 35 days post breeding, and costs for immediately, like you release the sows after breeding and that's it. And of course, conventional crate systems, lower costs, keep them on crates 35 days, intermediate costs, and just do the insemination and release the sows, higher costs. And then we're looking only to the facilities. We're not adding any type of productivity parameters. But then we did some simulations on like, okay, we have this higher cost, but how we implement different management practices to kind of let's improve 1% of breeding rates, for example. And then we have a reduction of like more than 100% on the production cost. So it's like we have really great levels being changed by 1% of improvement in some kind of rates and some kind of production parameters. So we know that it's cost involved and we need to talk about it and address it because someone needs to pay the bill. Otherwise, what we're going to see here in America in general, North America and South America, is just like what happened on some countries in Europe. Like it's like so expensive that people quit and they stop producing because they cannot pay for it. So how we avoid that happening and we implement welfare, but we make sure our producers keep producing. So it's like, can we implement some type of management practices so we help them to deal with the sow mortality and we help them to have some kind of public policy to help with that? So we had some really cool data on showing like how minor management practices could help a lot with reduction of this cost, like, because we know they're greater than producing in a conventional system. But it's what we say, they're not in conflict, welfare and economics. They need to walk together and we just need to focus on discussion on like how we do smart decision making to make sure we're keeping our producers producing basically.
That makes sense. Well, and the interesting thing is like outside of economics, when I talk to a lot of people that have moved to group sow housing, they say they'll never go back. Like they would never go back even if they could, because it's just like, it's a different way of managing the system, but like they just see that their animals are generally happier. And once they're used to the system, they like it.
Exactly. I think the transition is a little bit rough, but after you pass the transition moment for the animals, for you, your caretakers, and you understand the system and whatever you're using on the system, the machines and all that, they're really happy about it. And we know by walking on a barn with group house sows, it's like they're all relaxing, laying down, enjoying their lives. So it's like, it's really good to see these changes. And it's great that the producers also feel good about it. They walk on the barns with proud because they're like, I did this. I did the transition and we got in a good place. So
it's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Now I'm going to ask you the final three questions that we ask everyone. So the first one is, what is your favorite swine-related book or resource?
My favorite resource is going to be Nerd Alert. It's going to be a combination of scientific literature and direct interaction with farms. I think my favorite source is the producers. It's just spending time in the production system, listening to people, to producers. They often teach us as much as reading scientific papers. So I really enjoyed that. And I think on my academic trajectory, that made 100% different on my research and how I started thinking about things that could actually work on real farms. So
Yeah, I really like that response, because you get very different insights from visiting farms versus reading literature. So you kind of need both.
Exactly, because sometimes you're like, this is great. And they're like, okay, not that great. Let's talk about it. But sometimes they have brilliant ideas. You're like, why did I never thought about this before? Or like, well, you're not spending 20 hours of your day with a pig. So it's good to put both together.
Okay, so when it comes to a book or resource outside of agriculture, what is your favorite?
Okay, so the smart response will be books that discuss like system thinking, human behavior, that help explain how complex systems work and all that. But an honest answer will be true crime, basically.
Oh, cool. And any book in specific or?
Just general. I'm not a great reader. I wish I was more. I used to read a lot when I was younger, and I was just like, let's work and read a lot of papers. And then you're like, okay, I do not want to read anything else. But the few times I actually sit to enjoy is just general true crime books.
And then the last question, in your opinion, what sets successful swine professionals apart from those that are not?
That's a hard question. But I think I would say like, empathy combined with consistency. I think when you understand animals and you try to understand people and you try to understand the production system as a whole, like all of them are there together all the time, I think that makes a lot of difference. And this is essential to make sure we're making sustainable decisions in pig production and providing the best for people, for the animals, and for the society.
So thanks so much for joining me on the Swine in Canada podcast show today.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure.
All right. So to our listeners, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review because your feedback is invaluable to us. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.